Imagine you spit into a little plastic tube, you drop it in the mail, and you think nothing more of it than, hey, maybe I'll find out I have a long-lost cousin. But what you might not realize is that with that single vial of saliva, you just made this massive privacy decision on behalf of your siblings, your kids, and even your unborn grandchildren.
Right. You've essentially just published the biological blueprint for hundreds of people who, frankly, never consented to it.
Yeah, it's wild when you frame it like that.
Well, it's a staggering thought, right? And it really perfectly encapsulates this sort of double-edged sword of the genetic revolution we find ourselves in right now.
Exactly. And I'm so glad you brought that up because if you are listening to this deep dive today, you're likely the kind of smart colleague who already understands the high stakes of genealogical
Oh,
research.
absolutely. Our listeners know the drill.
Right. You know that combining, say, a 47 centimorgan DNA match with traditional paper documents can completely break down a brick wall in your family tree.
It's the holy grail of modern genealogy.
It really is. But I mean, to understand the true scale of what we're dealing with here, we have to look at the numbers. Like, think back to the year 2000.
Ah, the Dark Ages.
Seriously, DNA testing was this multi-thousand dollar laboratory procedure that took, what, weeks?
At least weeks, yeah. And then by 2010, it was just a consumer product in a shiny little box you could buy online.
Right, and now, as we stare down 2025, we are looking at this massive interconnected data set of over 50 million tested
Which
individuals.
is just, it's an absolute ocean of data.
It is.
And the implications are profound.
Yeah.
You know, not just for hobbyists, but for how we actually understand human history. I mean, we are no longer relying just on dusty parish records or census forms.
Yeah, those paper trails can only take you so far.
Exactly. DNA evidence can confirm documentary conclusions, it can resolve conflicts, and it can identify relatives the paper trail just completely forgot.
Which brings us to our mission today. We are bringing you up to speed on the underlying architecture of something incredibly specific, but just incredibly vital.
Max DNA schema.
Yes, the MaxDNA schema. This is the framework designed to literally bridge the gap between traditional documentary evidence and this explosive DNA revolution we just talked about.
But, and this is Babid, before we get into the brilliant mathematics of how it actually builds family trees, we have to address that terrifying privacy scenario you mentioned earlier.
We absolutely do, because that responsibility, that's the core of MaxDNA's design, isn't it?
It is the absolute foundation. We have to start at what we call the privacy baseline, which basically means understanding what the schema absolutely forbids from being stored.
Right.
Because a DNA breach, well, it's entirely different from a credit card breach.
Oh, totally. I mean, if my password gets stolen, I just change it. It's a huge headache, sure, but it's contained to me. But if my genome gets stolen, I can't exactly go and change my DNA.
Precisely. And neither can your relatives. So this schema handles this paradox. You know, building a highly useful DNA database that still rigorously respects genetic privacy with a core non-negotiable rule.
Okay, lay it on us.
There is a field in the schema called raw genotype stored, and its value is universally and permanently set to false.
False, period. So let's get specific about what that actually means biologically. We're talking about preventing the storage of those massive FASTQ or VCF files, right?
Exactly.
The ones that are basically gigabytes of raw biological source code, like all 3 billion chemical letters mapping out your exact physical makeup.
Correct. MaxDNA never, under any circumstances, stores raw genotype files.
So no FASTQ files, no VCFs.
None of them. And no raw text downloads from 23andMe or Ancestry DNA either. There is literally no way to store a raw genome in a MaxDNA record. The architecture simply won't allow it.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
If we completely refuse to store the actual raw genome, how do you build a DNA database without the actual DNA? It sounds like trying to run a library without any books.
I love that analogy.
Yeah.
But think of it more like keeping the card catalog and the book reviews, but not the book itself.
Oh, okay, so just the metadata.
Exactly. MaxDNA only stores the metadata. It keeps the match relationships between tested individuals, the shared centimorgans, the segment data needed for triangulation, the haplogroups.
So we are just keeping the conclusions of the DNA comparison, not the raw biological source code that actually generated those conclusions in the first place.
Right. You don't need a person's entire genetic sequence with all their sensitive medical predispositions just to know they share 50 centimorgans with someone else.
That makes total sense when you frame it as conclusions versus raw data. But You know, I noticed in the documentation that even this metadata is locked down incredibly hard.
Oh, heavily locked down.
Yeah, there's a field called redistribution license that enforces what's called an always tier 2 private architecture.
Yes, that field has a constant value of tier 2 private, which means a MaxDNA record can never appear in a public data set.
Never.
Never. It can never be returned in a public API response. It can't be put into a public embedding or pushed in a public commit, period. And what's really crucial here is that this applies to everyone, not just living people, but historical figures as well.
See, I see where you're going, but let me push back on the historical figures part.
Okay, sure.
If someone has been dead for 200 years, who really cares if their DNA metadata is public? Like, they aren't exactly applying for life insurance anymore.
True, but it goes back to your opening thought about the spit tube.
Huh?
DNA evidence that was generated by a living person inherently contains information about their ancestors, right?
Right.
Well, it works the other way, too. Reconstructed DNA from a historical figure, say, from a museum artifact or a royal exhumation that contains the genetic blueprint of their living descendants.
Oh, man, I didn't even think about that. So exposing the dead exposes the living.
Exactly. So the schema applies the most restrictive privacy setting universally.
Okay, so the data is locked down, but the system still has to actually function, right? If MaxDNA is storing this highly restricted metadata about relationships, it still has to point to specific DNA test kits.
Right, it needs to link records.
Like, it has to say kit A matches kit B. But if I can just read the plain text kit ID, I could potentially track that person down on a vendor's website. So how does the schema track these kits without exposing identities?
Cryptography.
Ah, of course.
Yeah, DNA kit identifiers, the actual account numbers from specific testing platforms, they are never stored in plain text. Instead, the schema uses hash kit identifiers.
I see.
Specifically, we're talking about the kitted hash and match katash fields.
Yeah, I noticed they enforce this strict 64-character hex pattern. Like any other format, just fails validation instantly.
Yep, it's very rigid.
But I want to dig into how that hash is generated because the schema specifies an HMAC SHA 256 hash computed with a system salt.
That's right.
Why not just use a standard SHA 256 hash? Like, why go through the trouble of adding the HMAC and the salt?
Well, that touches on how hackers actually operate in the real world.
Okay, walk me through that.
Let's say a hacker knows a certain DNA company's kit IDs always follow a predictable format like, say, two letters followed by six numbers.
Right. Pretty common.
A plain SHA 256 hash is just a direct mathematical translation. So a computer can just generate standard hashes for every single possible combination of two letters and six numbers.
Oh, so they just build a translation dictionary.
Exactly. They build a dictionary, run it against the hashes until it finds a match. That's called a brute force attack.
So a plain hash is basically just a thin disguise. It's not actually secure if you know the pattern.
Exactly. But the HMAC with a secret system salt changes the math entirely.
Because of the salt.
Yeah, because the system salt is this secret cryptographic key that gets mixed into the data before the hash is even generated. Without knowing that secret key, the hacker can't build that translation dictionary.
Wow. So it renders the kit ID completely irreversible.
Completely.
It's like putting your plain text kit ID inside a highly secure digital vault, scrambling the combination lock, and then just completely burning the piece of paper the combination was written on.
I love that. Yes.
You can still verify mathematically what is inside the vault by comparing it to another vault without ever having to open the door. You compute shared centimorgans, you find common ancestors, all without seeing the actual plain text kit number.
It really is an elegant solution, but you know, cryptography is only half of the privacy equation here.
What's the other half?
Strict consent rules.
Yeah.
Every MaxDNA record requires a consent status.
Okay.
This ranges from explicit opt-in for the subject to guardian consent for minors, to specific statuses for historical DNA.
Well, let me pause you there, because the most fascinating status to me is the withdrawn status.
Ah, yes. The cold feet scenario.
Exactly. Let's say I consent today. My data gets hashed. It's in the schema. It's out there solving family mysteries. But a year from now, I get nervous and I withdraw my consent.
Totally valid, right?
Right. But when most tech companies say delete, they usually mean, oh, we hide it from your dashboard, but keep it on our back-end servers forever to secretly train our algorithms. Is this schema doing that soft delete dance?
Absolutely not. The schema prioritizes the human over the tree, always.
So what actually happens?
The moment the status becomes withdrawn, it triggers a timestamp field called withdrawal requested at. And that timestamp initiates an absolutely ruthless 30-day purge cycle.
Meaning what, exactly?
After 30 days, the record is deleted entirely, not archived, not retained on some obscure backup server.
Wow.
It is mathematically eradicated from the schema.
I mean, that might leave a gap in the family tree, though.
It might. But the core belief of MaxDNA is that genetic privacy is a fundamental right, not a preference.
That is incredibly stark, but honestly, it's very comforting.
Yeah, it builds trust.
So we've established the firewall. The data is secured, it's irreversibly anonymized, and it has an ironclad self-destruct button. Now let's look at how the genealogy actually works.
Let's get into the fun stuff.
Yes. How does the schema actually compare to people?
For that, we have to look at the matches array. This is where the schema holds DNA match assertions. Basically, there's one assertion for each genetic relative the system has found.
Right. And the fields in this array are pretty much what you'd expect. You've got shared send demand for total shared centimortens, longest segment centimeters, segment count.
Yep. The standard metrics.
And optionally, a chromosome segments array for detailed triangulation. But as I was reading through the source material, I realized there is this massive biological trap hidden in how we talk about this data.
Oh, you mean the centimorgan illusion?
Yes. Because we treat centimorgans like inches on a ruler, but they aren't physical measurements, are they?
No, they aren't at all. And this is exactly what we call the centimorgan illusion. Physical DNA distance is measured in base pairs.
Right, actual physical chemical letters.
Exactly. But a centimorgan is a measure of genetic distance. Specifically, it's the probability that a segment of DNA will recombine or break apart during the creation of an egg or sperm cell.
Wait, so if we aren't measuring physical distance, we're literally measuring a statistical probability. Meaning you have to somehow map a physical sequence to a statistical likelihood. How does a database even do that without a massive conversion table?
You've hit the nail on the head. You do need a conversion table.
Ah.
It's called a recombination map. It's a statistical table that estimates how frequently recombination occurs at each specific physical position in the genome.
Okay, so that sounds complicated, but straightforward enough if you have the map.
The problem is science doesn't have just one map.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The major ones like HapMap, DECODE, ADB, Shape84, they were all developed by different research groups at different times using different methods.
I'm trying to picture the margin of error here. If they use different maps, are we talking fractions of a percent, or is this a discrepancy that could actually ruin a family tree?
Oh, they can differ by up to 15%.
15%?
Yes. So a 50 centimorgan match calculated using the HapMap might only show up as a 42 centimorgan match on the DECODE map.
That is wild. That's like trying to frame a house where one carpenter is measuring all the wood in inches and the other carpenter is measuring in centimeters.
And neither of them bothers to write down their unit of measurement on the blueprints.
Exactly. You are going to end up with wildly inaccurate, dangerously wrong relationship estimates.
It's a structural disaster. If you combine those numbers without knowing which map was used, your math is broken right from the start.
So how does the schema fix this?
This is why the MaxDNA schema mandates a field called Synapse Version on every single match.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Right. By forcing the system to declare the map version, downstream tools can recognize the discrepancy and apply the appropriate mathematical conversions.
So suddenly, the carpenters are finally speaking the same language.
Exactly.
Okay, so having an accurate genetic distance is crucial. But to confidently place an ancestor on a family tree, distance isn't enough. You have to know which side of the family the DNA actually came from, maternal or paternal.
Yes, and that brings us to the phasing status field.
Phasing.
Right. Phasing is the process of assigning a specific DNA segment to a specific parent. The schema tracks whether a match is maternal, paternal, unphased, unknown, or both.
Wait, both seems contradictory. How can a segment come from both sides?
It's rare, but it happens in cases of inbreeding or extreme endogamy.
Oh, where the identical segment is found on both the maternal and paternal chromosome.
Exactly. But for most typical research, determining if it's strictly maternal or paternal is essential for triangulation.
Right.
If you share a segment with a known paternal cousin and you know the segment is phased paternal, that means it physically resides on the same chromosome as your paternal grandfather's segment.
That is hard physical evidence.
It doesn't get much better than that.
Let me synthesize this because this is where the rubber really meets the road for me.
Okay, go for it.
We have accurate, properly mapped, phased, highly secure DNA matches. But how does this digital schema actually shake hands with my paper trail? You know, the birth certificates, the census records.
This happens through a module called MaxPerson. And there are two main mechanisms for this.
Okay, what's the first?
First, the personed field links the max DNA record directly to the max person profile of the test taker.
Simple enough.
Second, the max person profile has an array called DNA evidence. And this stores the entire chain of DNA that touches this person as a candidate for a most recent common ancestor.
So when a DNA match is confirmed, say we use triangulation to prove two people share a specific great-grandfather, the schema populates a field called common ancestor candidates right on the match record.
Yes, exactly.
And it logs a per-candidate confidence score, plus an inference method like manual entry, tree intersection, or shared surname geography.
Spot on. And once that connection is firmly made, these pieces of evidence flow upward into what we call the noisy OR calculation engine.
Okay, I really want to break down the math here because this noisy OR concept is just brilliant. It fundamentally changes how we calculate proof. Mm-hmm. Explain how this engine actually combines our evidence.
Sure. Let's look at the statistics of independent probabilities.
Okay.
Let's say you have a documentary claim paper records. The person A and person B share an ancestor. The paper trail is decent, but maybe a census record is smudged or ambiguous.
Happens all the time.
Right. So your confidence score for the paper trail is 0.8. That means you are 80% confident it's true, which also means there is a 20% chance it is entirely false.
Okay, pretty good, but you wouldn't bet your house on it.
Exactly. Now, completely independently, you introduce a DNA match of 47 centimorgans. Right. On its own, that DNA match might only give you a confidence of 0.6, so 60%, because 47 centimorgans could mean third cousins or it could mean half-second cousins once removed. It's ambiguous.
Right, so there's a 40% chance your specific relationship hypothesis is wrong based just on the DNA.
Yes, so we have an 80% paper confidence and a 60% DNA confidence.
And I think a lot of people might just average those together and get, what, 70%?
Which would be mathematically incorrect.
Right.
Because these are independent lines of evidence. The noisy OR calculation doesn't average them. It looks at the probability that both of these independent pieces of evidence are false at the exact same time.
Oh, I see.
It multiplies the 20% failure rate of the paper trail by the 40% failure rate of the DNA.
Oh, wow. So 0.20 multiplied by 0.40, that's 0.08.
Exactly. There is only an 8% chance that both the paper documents and the biological DNA,
mm-hmm.
are accidentally pointing to the exact same wrong ancestor independently.
Which means, wait, if there's only an 8% chance they're both wrong, that flips to a 92% confidence that they are right?
Yes. The 0.8 and the 0.6 fuse into a 0.92 combined confidence.
That is incredible. The resulting combined confidence is significantly higher than either piece of evidence could ever be on its own.
It is incredibly powerful, assuming, of course, the evidence is properly linked in that the evidence array.
Right. But, and I see a biological assumption here.
Whoa.
That noisy OR math is brilliant, but it assumes those probabilities are truly independent because it assumes your ancestors came from a large, randomly mating population.
Yes.
But human history is absolutely full of isolated, tightly knit communities where people did not mate randomly.
You've identified the massive challenge of endogamy.
Yes.
And the schema absolutely has to account for that, which is why it includes the endogamy flag and endogamy population fields.
Right. Because if we look at populations like Ashkenazi Jews, Akkadians, Mennonites, the Amish, or, you know, island populations, these groups married within their own small communities for hundreds of years.
Meaning everyone shares DNA with everyone else. It's basically a genetic soup.
So what happens to the math?
Well, if you use standard algorithms, like that beautiful noisy OR NGR math we just talked about, on a highly endogamous population, it will falsely inflate the relationships.
Because it thinks independence is happening when it isn't.
Exactly. It might flag someone as a first cousin, simply because they share a massive amount of small, identical segments of DNA. But in reality, they might just be your fifth cousin, five times over, through different ancestral lines.
So the schema uses that endogamy flag as this massive warning sign.
Yes.
It essentially tells the downstream tools, hey, do not use the standard centimorgan thresholds here. You need to recalibrate the math for this specific population.
That's precisely what it does. But, you know, even with recalibrated math, autosomal DNA, the DNA that recombines every generation, it has hard limits in those endogamous populations.
It just gets too messy.
Yeah. To really break through that genetic soup, you need a different tool entirely. Which brings us to haplogroups.
Ah, this is where we bypass recombination entirely.
I do.
The schema stores haplogroup E for the direct paternal line and haplogroup for the direct maternal line. And I noticed it uses the ISOCH naming conventions, which update as the science advances.
Right. Why DNA and mitochondrial DNA don't recombine? They are passed down largely intact, changing only through very occasional once-in-history mutations.
Right.
And these mutations define haplogroups, which are basically massive branches of the human family tree.
Let's use the real-world example from the source material to show why capturing this detail is so important, because I thought it was a perfect illustration.
Oh, the Maxwell example.
Yes. Let's say you are a researcher looking into the Maxwell family, mm-hmm. sometimes spelled Mixwell historically, and you are trying to prove their Scottish origins.
Okay.
If your Y-DNA haplogroup is just recorded broadly in a database as RM269, that is effectively useless.
It really is. RM269 is associated with the Neolithic expansion across Western Europe from thousands of years ago. I mean, millions of men have it.
Right. Knowing you have RM269 tells you almost nothing about a specific Scottish ancestor from, say, the 1600s.
No, it doesn't.
But if the schema can store a highly detailed downstream haplogroup-like RBY36553, that changes the entire game.
Yes, because that is a rare, specific subgroup mutation found almost exclusively in the Scottish borders.
Exactly. Storing that precise level of detail can confirm a specific Scottish origin hypothesis with remarkable precision, cutting right through any endogamy you might have on the autosomal side.
And being able to store that exact level of precision uniformly across different records is exactly why MaxDNA exists in the first place.
Right.
If we step back and look at the fundamental problem in genetic genealogy today, it is fragmentation. We are dealing with a fractured collection of proprietary silos.
Oh, it's a nightmare. You test on Ancestry DNA, your cousin tests on 23andMe, your aunt is over on FamilyTree DNA or MyHeritage.
And a match that appears on one platform doesn't easily translate to another. Each of these silos has its own database, its own set of Morgan mapping tools, its own privacy rules.
It's incredibly frustrating for anyone trying to do serious research.
Which is why MaxDNA is not trying to be just another database to add to the pile. It is designed to be the unified, secure exchange format.
The bridge.
Yes. It is the architectural standard that pulls all these silos together. It allows a match identified on one platform to be mathematically combined with documentary evidence from another, creating a unified picture while still maintaining that ironclad privacy we talked about.
It's basically taking the Wild West frontier of genetic genealogy and laying down a highly secure, standardized highway right through the middle of it.
I think that's incredibly well said.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final, somewhat provocative thought to mull over.
I love these.
We started by talking about the stakes of this data, combining the paper trail of historical documents with the mathematical precision of DNA. But as schemas like MaxDNA perfect the mathematics of these secure genetic hashes, and as millions more people test every single year,
yeah.
How long is it until the actual paper trail of humanity becomes secondary to the mathematically infallible hash trail?
Oh, wow. That is a profound shift in how we record human history.
It really is. I mean, think about it. Will future historians even care about the smudged census records or the biased written journals of our ancestors?
Probably not as much.
Right. Or will they rely entirely on the irreversible cryptography of our metadata to tell them exactly who we were and who we loved and where we came from? When the puzzle pieces are made of math instead of paper, the picture they form might just outlast the paper itself.
A truly fascinating thing to consider.
Definitely. Keep digging, keep exploring, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.